Today's episode is brought to you by Truly Odd Tees. Show your love for the paranormal with ghost hunting themed tees. Show off your favorite cryptids and paranormal topics. Head over to trulyoddtees.com to weird up your wardrobe and use promo code GHOSTHUNTER10 at checkout to take 10% off your order. As always, orders over $75 ship free inside the continental United States.
On this episode of Ghost Hunter Advice, we talk to Mary Shoresman of Montana Paranormal about building her knowledge base, learning the ropes, and starting a team in an extremely rural part of the nation. If that's something you're struggling with, you're absolutely going to want to stay tuned. We also go over some of her cases, stories from the field, and some stuff that she went through learning the ropes. Definitely an episode you're not going to want to miss.
Advice from the pros. Advice from the pros. Stories from the haunted. From the haunted. You're listening to the Ghost Hunter Advice Podcast.
Welcome back to Ghost Hunter Advice. I am your host, Tanner, and I am joined today by Mary Shoresman of Montana Paranormal. Mary, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you today?
I'm doing great. And I got the name right that time, right?
I know, yeah. Great. Good job.
So you've been going since about 2015. Let's go ahead and get right into this. What got you into the paranormal?
So, of course, as a child, I would go and visit my grandma when I was young, and that's what she would do. She'd sit down and she'd watch sci-fi. She'd watch the Travel Channel, the History Channel, you know, anything that wasn't quite real. I don't want to say real, but at that time it was a lot of, you know, sci-fi fantasy things. And it was just so fascinating. And so growing up, that was just kind of what I mashed into and became was, a junkie on that stuff. And so I just grew with it. And I've always, you know, I was big into the ghost hunters. And once they really started putting the shows on TV, I was just, you never miss an episode. There for it.
Now, what took you from being a paranormal fan to actually getting out and doing investigations?
So it wasn't until 2015, actually, that I actually participated in an investigation. My sister was getting married in Missouri, and there was a tour group at the Missouri State Penitentiary, and I decided that was going to be her bridal shower. We were going to go on a paranormal investigation, and she loves this stuff, too, and she had one bridesmaid, and she loved it as well. And so we went and we had a great time and just really soaked it in. At that point, I was hooked, and I had to find more ways to get live interaction versus the TV shows. And
Awesome.
Just really rolled out from there.
I was going to ask, like, doing that for a bridal shower, I really hope that she's into that. It's like, hey, sis, you're getting married. That's great. Let's go hang out with some dead guys in a prison.
I know, instead of those guys at the bar, man, let's go see what these have to offer. They've been around longer.
Yeah, dying in a men's prison, let's throw a bachelorette party right in there. That's awesome. What kind of activity did you get? I'm sorry, what type of activity did you get while you were in there?
There wasn't a lot, actually. I don't think at that time we took it real seriously. We didn't know how to really go about it and interact, and so we just kind of walked around and enjoyed ourselves, and we more so just really took in the scenery, and we watched what, you know, the tour guides were doing. And, you know, that was a lot of fun. And that was before there were all these toys and different interactive devices. And so it was very raw. It was very, you have your recorder and we're going to look for EVPs and we're going to walk around and listen for sounds. And so It was a cool experience. It was really unique for our first time, and we really had a good time. But I can't say we necessarily really, really took it in enough to experience anything, but at that point, I was like, we have to do more. We have to find something.
Wanting to find more and wanting to get something, is that what took you from doing this from a public hunt to going out and doing your own team? Or did you slide into another paranormal team to learn the ropes and get a bit more experience?
Honestly, it was the tour guides, the tour groups. They just kind of blew up all over and they started coming this way more to the west and became more available because living in Montana, there's, you know, things weren't as prominent. You couldn't really find this stuff without traveling. And that time wasn't something that I could do. And so there was a time frame where I didn't actually participate in any sort of paranormal group or experience or, you know, outing. And so once after quite a few years, I want to say it was maybe a 5-year drought. And that was when I was like, finally, okay, I'm going to go to some cemeteries. You know, I've been craving this stuff, watching it on TV for this long is just not filling that void. And so, you know, at that point I'm going to cemeteries and I'm, you know, just, I didn't have any devices. It was, just kind of hanging out and taking it in and, just really taking in your surroundings and what is there. It was more of like a very solemn, respectful sort of visit, I would say. And then
during that time period where you weren't using devices and you were hitting cemeteries in different areas, what did you learn during that? Just being out there yourself, like what were your experiences like and what did you learn about investigating the paranormal then?
Yeah. So I learned to really listen, to really pay attention to anything out of the normal. You really have to use your senses and your intuition on, you know, maybe I should go to this area. Something just feels, you know, sort of a draw, a pull. And so you kind of just more so learn to trust your gut. And I did that for a while. And then I finally got my first like audio recorders and tools because I went on another tour. And once that stuff started coming out, I was like, oh, cool. You know, I love to go and experience just the real raw, but now I can actually get these tools and learn how to use them and develop from there. And so I would take, that's what, you know, I got my recorders and maybe some kayak balls. Yeah, those are our favorite. Yeah, the music boxes as well. But I distinctly, probably a year ago, was my real first unreal experience where I went to this really small graveyard that we have here in town. And I laid out a couple audio devices. For some reason, I did not put on my camera at that time. I only had my cell phone. It was the only recording device that I could afford and that I used. And for some reason, I didn't turn that on, but I had my recorders. They were sitting on a few tombstones and I was kind of just asking questions and playing them back and seeing if anything really stood out. And right before I left, I had this real, just unreal experience where there was a tree probably 10 feet away from me. And then the tombstones were probably 20 feet away from me. And this shadow figure, it sounds crazy. It's absolutely nuts. Even thinking about it gives me, like, makes my heart race, you know, just so distinct. This shadow figure just kind of hunched over, just darts from this tree to these tombstones and is gone. And it was so distinct. You could make out two legs. And then the rest, because it was in a hunched over position, was just kind of a ball of black. It was a half body. But when I played over in my head, like it was so slow motion, but it was like a split second, but you can just see two legs very distinctly. You can see the background behind them when it's running. And it just disappears into a tombstone. And I think the best, the real validating part of that was that when I played back my recorders, I hear myself gasp, you know, I hear my reaction and I hear myself asking it. Of course, I was like, oh my gosh, you know, did I scare you? You know, everybody says that shadow figures are not good, but there was nothing that I sensed bad. At that point, I was like, I thought I scared it.
Yep.
And so the person in me is asking like if I scared it, and then it's like, or wait, it's like, were you trying to scare me? And you know, just you just play it back and you just hear this conversation with it, and it's just, it was so surreal, but then it was so validating, and I'll never forget it.
Yeah, that's fantastic. There's a theory like with that, with a lot of people want to put labels on everything. And when it comes to like shadow people or certain types of manifestations, they'll say that's evil, that's bad, stay away from it.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is rooted in superstition and things that don't really have even anecdotal evidence to back up those claims. It's just people want to understand stuff. One of my favorite theories, and something that that we've experienced before on cases, is time fluctuations, where you have one point on the timeline interacting with another point on the timeline. And so like you get these bleed overs where it looks like a shadow person, or it looks like a person, or it looks like an apparition, and it's actually just in a different time period. And like you're seeing them and you're like, oh God, a ghost. And you're like backing up, and they're doing the same thing in their time period. Yeah. I think one of the most famous examples of that, there was a subway, and in the night, I want to say the 19, it was early. I think it was like 1950s or 60. Or, it was before blue jeans were a thing, like a big thing. Oh, wow. These people said they saw these weird apparitions and these ghosts, and they were wearing blue pants and like bright colors. And then I believe it was the 90s, and I'll have to look this up for another episode. But another group in that same spot described people from the 1940s is what it was. Described people from the 1940s. And when they put those two, somebody went through, as a historical researcher, went through, found those two accounts and was like, oh my God, these two people from these two different decades were interacting with each other, and they were each other's ghosts.
That's unreal.
It's crazy. Everybody tries to put everything to one box. All ghosts are spirits of the dead, all ghosts are demons, or everything paranormal is in people's heads. Everybody's probably right. There's enough weird out there, and there's things that fit with one theory that don't fit with the other. So you might have what do we call it? We call them time slips. You might have a time slip in one area. You might have an intelligent haunting in one area. You might have a residual. You might have all three going on in the same area. And when you run across stuff like that, it's so interesting when they're as afraid of us as we are of them.
That's exactly. And that's exactly what I sensed. And it was, it wasn't dark out. It was like dusk. It was that time where you leave the cemetery or you get in trouble. Mm-hmm. And this blacker than black, just crazy. And that's what I sensed, was that I scared it. You know, I'm in its area, probably not used to somebody being there. That's probably why my immediate reaction was, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. You know?
So being out in Montana, you're going to graveyards and you're doing historical areas. When I hear about Montana, like I automatically assume that it's just mountains, bears, and Bigfoot. So what was it like? I have a lot of people that call on the show. They're from rural areas, out in different parts with farms and stuff. You're in freaking Montana and you started a team. What was that like? And are you doing residential now, or are you still doing mainly historical?
We do everything. We've got a residential coming up on the 17th. And that one's going to be huge. The things that the client has really explained to us, and how many people have witnessed this activity. It's going to be really neat. It is actually our first residential. And so it's just going to be a completely different experience, as is every place we've gone, every business, every building, every investigation has been different, which is just so cool and solidifying.
With going out and doing what you're doing right now, you're doing businesses, you're doing public hunts, you're doing graveyards. Are you more into collecting evidence for yourself? Are you trying to prove something? Or are you more into, you know what, these people are having some stuff go on, let's just give them this so they don't feel like they're nuts?
You know, we actually leave that up to the client, what they're looking for. We have this procedure where we send out, of course, legal forms. We send out a client questionnaire where they kind of fill in what they're experiencing, if anyone else has done it, you know, they, you know, who lives here? Are there animals? How far away are is water sources and electrical wiring? How, you know, when was the building built? A lot of really like important questions that we use in order to almost come in to disprove it, you know, because that's our mindset, is that you have to think along the box of it's not paranormal first. And if we can't explain it, then we question it. And so that's when we leave it up to the client. One of the questions is, what are you looking to get out of this investigation? And some of them just are thrill seekers, and they, you know, they swear it's paranormal, and they just want that evidence so they can, you know, show people. And then some genuinely are afraid. Some are just curious, as in, do they have something going on? They're not sure, but weird things happen. And so it's, we really leave it up to the client of how they want us to go about this and what they want out of it.
The number one way to tell the level of an investigator is the quality of the questions they ask. That question, the location of energy sources in and around your home, is fantastic. How long have you been like actually running the team and investigating?
We are fresh, coming up maybe close to a year since I started it. It's really not been a really long time. I ran out of tour groups and cemeteries, and I'm such a junkie that I was like, I need more.
You know, where did you learn like what questions to ask and to put on your forms?
I read a lot of books. Cool. I do as much research and try to learn really as much as I can about how to do this, what's important, what needs to be evaluated. And so even when I go on different outings, I still base the way we conduct business on these published books and journals and different just educational pieces of material instead of fantasy.
You hear that, guys? She's in Montana. Team's been running for about a year. She learned how to investigate and do it well from books. And it's amazing how that works. All of these little pieces of paper and stuff that are out there to convey information. Everybody wants to join a team, and they get down in the dumps because they can't find a team. And being an investigator is about getting over, under, and through obstacles. Things are going to pop up in your way. You're going to be in areas that are not very populated. You're going to be in areas where nobody believes in the paranormal, and you're going to feel like a weirdo out by yourself doing this stuff, sitting around in graveyards, reading books and learning how to do things. And you know what? If you're an investigator, you're going to get over it, and you're going to do those things and do what Mary's done and figure it out and do a fantastic job doing that. And the big thing is, don't be afraid to screw up. I mean, what's your favorite mistake? Well, I say favorite mistake, but what's the mistake that you've made so far that you've learned the most from?
You know, and that's actually a really good question, because I try to talk with my team after each investigation on what we feel like we could improve on, what we didn't necessarily do the best, what we think we did really well and works really well. And so we have these conversations so that we can grow and develop and do better every single time. And my biggest downfall, and probably the team's agreement, is video footage. I'm a junkie. I'm an absolute video junkie, because that is what, to me, you can share with the client, solid footage. It's not just this report that says we experienced this, and this is what we came up with. When they can put this report next to the video, it's gold. It's so important to me, because we set it up to where you can tell we don't, you know, fake anything. I'll set a camera up in the corner of the room so you can see us at all times. I'll set it up in hallways so that you can see down the entire hallway which rooms we're going into. I really want to make it the most real experience that the client can have. It's like as if they're with us. And this
That's a mistake that a lot of newbies and a lot of really experienced investigators do. When you set up the camera angles, you get everything that you need, but you don't set up overlapping footage and you don't set up things where when something happens, it's obviously going to be paranormal, where the chair gets pulled over to the side of the video and there's a possibility somebody was holding the leg, or like a key piece of footage has a question. Setting up cameras improperly so that you miss what you're mm-hmm. what you're going for, not just here, but as a private investigator, I did a lot of surveillance for like child abuse cases and for different things. We called it dramatic evidence. And your report, your findings as an investigator, the things that happen to you, the readings off of the equipment that you're using, the feelings and sensations and touches and experiences that the investigators get. Yes, that is the case. And that's how you're going to learn. That's how you're going to figure out what's going on there and learn what's happening at the property. But that dramatic evidence, good, yep. solid dramatic evidence, has an emotional effect on the client, has an emotional effect on the judge in private investigations or the jury. And it makes that data real and it mm-hmm. helps tell the story.
Yep. And so getting that footage together, uploading it, finding out how to get through it the quickest way possible and get it to the client is probably what I struggle with, because I have no, you know, technology experience, which I just taught myself how to run a program that I now can piece things together and really highlight the really important parts of the investigation and not just an empty room for hours. mm-hmm. Because we that's one of the things. They get a report and they get all of the footage. They get all of it so that they can really see what actually happened, because it's not like the TV shows. it can be boring. The review, it's tedious. It's time consuming. And when I don't get those videos uploaded correctly and half of them become corrupt, it is heartbreaking. And so every investigation, I am trying to learn how to do it better and more efficiently. And so I'd say that's probably what we struggle with the most right now. But like I said, I've just downloaded some software and I'm teaching myself how to use it. And I think going forward, things are going to be really great.
That doesn't change with like storing and doing the evidence as technology changes. It just keeps becoming a different problem. So like you'll learn how to do it now. And like I got my DVR down, was like, yeah, awesome. And then I ended up switching mainly to GoPro type units that I was able to switch out and make full spectrum. And now I'm getting ready to switch to NVR. So like every time you get it down and you're like, yep, okay, I got it. You end up switching out or doing something like, back when we first started, I used high 8mm, cameras, film cameras, mm-hmm. Doing the reveal. And that was a nightmare because you could only go so fast or so slow, but oh my God, evidence review, it's paranormal or illegal. Oh my God, it's so time consuming and so boring,
and it never fails. I always have somebody who's like, oh God, look at all those orbs. Yep.
We do not believe in orbs. That is one of my biggest things that I try to stress to our clients or to anybody that watches any of our films, because everybody wants to call every speck of dust or every particle an orb. Yep. Look at all those orbs. I'm like, no, please, this is dust.
And when you get something like it with orbs, what you're seeing is the reflection of the IR light or a reflection of a secondary light source off of a dust particle, a bug, or something flying through the air. I've seen it on spider webs and spiders crawling across webs. When you do get something that is emitting its own light source, you can tell that that's what it is, but that's still probably not a ghost. There are natural pockets of electromagnetic energy that'll show up on some very, very sensitive, very high-end cameras, but it's not a ghost. It's just a random bubble of energy, especially like if you, The best video that I've seen for this is there was a breaker box that was set up by a complete idiot, and it was just bleeding and leaching energy out into the area. And you could see little, it looked kind of like sparks, but there weren't sparks to the naked eye there, but it was just high levels of energy that were coming out of the actual device and mm-hmm. out of the poor insulation. Now, if you're standing in a room and you see an orb, a massive floating glowing light,
yep,
maybe you got something.
Right. And that's what our next client has explained to me, is that he was sitting in his home, and next thing he knows, this blue glowing ball of something that kind of grew and then retracted and just kind of almost pulsed, and it was blue. I'm like, that's something, you know. He said it just stayed in the same spot. It didn't float around. It just hung out there. And that is something that really catches my attention. I'm like, that is something that I don't know that we can explain.
Mm-hmm.
And he said it wasn't tiny. And so I'm excited to see what we can catch there, because he doesn't know anything about paranormal. He doesn't research orbs, you know, things like that. And so when somebody that has no experience explains an activity like that, it's just, wow, that has to be something. We have to figure out what that is.
And a random manifestation of energy is most likely going to appear as a ball or a three-dimensional spherical shape. The sphere is the easiest and most natural shape to happen in nature. Raindrops, when they fall from the sky, are spherical. As gravity pulls them, they get that teardrop shape. When there's stars, gravity that the planets, gravity that pulls things around it, it's spherical usually, because that's the easiest form for it to manifest. And when something is manifesting, it takes a lot of energy, and we have a pretty good idea. I don't like to say that we know, but we have a pretty good idea that it's a massive pull for them to be able to visually manifest in front of us and physically manifest in front of us. So it makes sense that that would be happening in a sphere.
Yes.
And the same thing for natural orbs that happen, like in the light outlet where those things were shooting out and the camera could see it. It's going to look spherical. You light a candle. The light emitted off of the actual flame appears to be spherical. Flashlights, glowing LED lights. It's spherical for a reason, and that's how it holds. I'm not a physicist. I'm an investigator, but there's a reason for that. And yeah, and getting back to video. If you guys are interested, if you go to Montana Paranormal's Facebook page, you can jump on there and see the video and see the shots that we're talking about with some of these. You've also got some videos up from the Libby Hotel. Now we jumped off for a break here. We started talking about this experience that you had where you had a disembodied voice,
mm-hmm.
and you heard it, and it was picked up by the camera. So yeah. I always find disembodied voices a little bit more interesting than EVPs, because we heard them, we know nobody's there.
Exactly.
Picked up by the camera.
Yeah. And that happened a few times throughout the night. I'd hear one of the investigators setting boundaries. She's extremely sensitive. She's, you know, we consider her our psychic on the team. She's incredible, and she's never wrong. And she was, you know, sensing something that wasn't right. She was having some sort of odd effect that she felt the need to really make it, or whatever was affecting her, to understand that there's boundaries and you need to stop. And as she's walking down the hall and she's stating these things very loudly in my ear, I hear, no. And that happened twice that night, during the same sort of conversation that her and the other girl were having, setting boundaries. I hear no in my ear, and it's very loud. It's like a very loud yelling whisper. And so of course the other one that I heard was this that is in this clip, and I'm also uploading the other video to our YouTube channel. And if that you anybody wants to check that out, it's much better quality.
Yeah, and don't be afraid, like when you're going through and you're getting your evidence and you're getting ready to post it, I recommend everybody post the original and then something that's enhanced so that people can hear what you're hearing. Yep. As long, and this comes from like even showing stuff in court, you have the original, you document what everything that you do to it, mm-hmm. and then post the it's best evidence, whatever the best evidence to relay what actually happened is what you show.
Yeah. And it's, we play the whole clip and then I afterwards replay it. So they get the raw footage and then slow down to really enhance what we're trying to show.
Now, your website, is it montanaparanormal.com?
It is mtparanormal.com.
Cool. mtparanormal.com.
MT.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, if you Google Montana Paranormal, it's going to take you to some sort of very old website that apparently there was another Montana Paranormal. I don't even know how long ago. So I always have to tell people, I'm like, don't go to that one.
That was the 90s and early 2000s. I remember those guys. I thought that maybe you had taken over the team from that.
Oh, cool.
So go to mtparanormal.com. Now, with the books that we talked about that you read earlier, mm-hmm. if you go to, I believe it's the resources page.
Yeah.
There is a list of books and it's a good list of resources if you were looking to learn how to ghost hunt and learn how to run, you know, a professional investigation for your own curiosity or to help others. And that's a great list. Not a lot of teams do that.
Oh yeah. I've got some more that I need to add. I'm always trying to find newer ones and better ones and ones with information that aren't in the others necessarily. And so I've got a few that I need to add to that.
That's fantastic. Now, structuring your team, when you got everything set up, the website looks great. You do something interesting that I haven't seen that I really like. You have a calendar up that shows your available dates. It also shows when you're booked and when you're doing investigations, and you're mm-hmm. fairly busy.
Yeah. Yeah. We try to do one a month because we have a promise to our client to have their report within 30 days. And so with all of that and the footage review, having more than one a month becomes a little overwhelming. So
especially if you're doing multiple nights, I know a lot of people want to go out and do all of this stuff. Like when I run an investigation, it's a month to 2 months long to finish it. I'll go out to their house. I'll probably go a few times. If I can, I'll leave equipment there. My favorite thing to do is to, if you have an MVR or a DVR that's going to record for a week, set that sucker up and let it record for a week. That way you're able to get what you need. And then doing multiple vigils. A lot of people, they make the mistake of calling the investigation the night that they actually go out and do the vigil. The vigil is just a part of it.
Yep.
The investigation is the background, the interviews, the vigil, the review, the findings, and then the closing that you do with the client. That entire thing is the investigation. And you might do, you know, 4 to 6 vigils on an investigation, especially if it's something where you're not getting a whole lot of activity because maybe it doesn't want to show itself, especially if you're working with, I hate using the D word, but when you're doing those more demonic style investigations or you're doing something where you have children being affected and it's more of a negative type thing, you're probably going to spend some time there, especially if you're wanting a cleansing or if you're wanting a reputable religious organization or organization to come in to clear it. There's a lot of boxes that have to be checked to get that to happen.
Yep. And unfortunately, one of the questions on our questionnaire is about mental health. Mm-hmm. And that's, we ask that because things, you know, sometimes mental health coincides with experiences that somebody thinks are paranormal. And we also like to know what we might be walking into for our safety and for the client's safety. And I hate that we have to ask people about that because it feels so private, but it's important. And nobody seems to have an issue with it, which is great.
Yep. And I used to feel super weird about that, but we're there to investigate. We're there to help them. And we need all of the information.
Just because you're schizophrenic doesn't mean you're not haunted.
Yeah, exactly.
But we need to know that, because if we do need to call somebody in for help, they're going to ask that question. If it's been hidden and it looks like we or you were deceiving them, chances are they are not going to help. Especially when you're dealing with those larger churches, they don't like scandal. It's our job as investigators, if we're looking to call them in, to make sure that they're not going to be.
Exactly. You really got to have your ducks in a row before you jump to any sort of conclusion, because that really puts a bad name. It's you don't want to have that reputation of jumping to it is demonic and we need, you know, an exorcism. Luckily, we haven't run into anything that we would necessarily call bad or evil or anything like that. And everybody always jumps to it's paranormal, it's got to be a demon. You know, sometimes negative things happen. Sometimes something that's not negative still negatively affects someone in the household, but that doesn't make it demonic or dangerous. Or, well, it can be dangerous, but that doesn't make the entity a scary and dangerous thing.
And sometimes we're perceiving it wrong. Like sometimes something is just trying to make contact and it scares the bejesus out of the client and everybody thinks it's evil, because you have to remember that we as human beings, we view the world through filters. Our perception is based around our upbringing, our religious backgrounds, things that we believe in truths. There's a difference between truth and fact. People can have their own truths. Facts are facts.
Yep.
In 22 years? Yeah. 22 years of doing these investigations, there have been a handful of things that I would say were negative or dangerous. And there have been two demonics that actually needed exorcism. 22 years, two that went that way. So that is how rare it is for someone that doesn't specialize in that stuff.
Yep.
That you're going to run into
exactly.
It. So it's not like it is on television.
I heard somewhere that 99.9% of paranormal activity is not demonic. It is the first thing that people think of, and it is the last thing that is happening.
Thank you, television.
I know. And media.
I mean, I'm a horror writer. So, I mean, I guess people want to jump toward that. Everybody wants to have their own story. Everybody wants to be a part of something that's huge. And when something like this happens, you think like 1% of paranormal activity, we'll say that is might be demonic. That's of the stuff that is legit paranormal activity. As an investigator, 9 out of 10 are not even paranormal.
Right.
So you've got a rarity inside of a rarity.
Yep. Exactly.
Now getting back onto your team, you guys structured as a nonprofit. And this is a massive segue to turn back into. But one of the reasons that I wanted to have you on the show was to talk about that. Instead of just launching the team and doing what most people do with this being a hobby, and sometimes they'll take donations or something to put toward the investigations, what specifically made you want to structure as a nonprofit?
I strive on professionality. I have this very big respect for professional behavior, and being a business and then becoming nonprofit, letting people know that we're not here for money, we're not here for fame, anything like that, you know, that we're very legal, we're very respectful. That's important to me, because then people will gravitate towards you more so than a team that is thrill-seeking. Because if we can put that legality behind the team, it shows our responsibility and our true motive to legitimately help instead of just going in and exploring. And that's something that we really love.
Awesome. So it wasn't a business thing where you wanted to make sure that if you were, for tax reasons, if you were selling merchandise, which I noticed you do sell some merchandise there on the website. I've done that over the past to pay for equipment, because this is stupid expensive. To do as a hobby. So you did this purely to garner trust
in your clients. Let them know that you're not there for financial gain. You're there to help. You're there to learn.
Yeah.
In your experience, and I know your background is in finance, and you're looking to go into in as a CPA. Were there some tax benefits to doing that?
Honestly, no. Oh. I mean, there can be tax benefits, but we just recently became a nonprofit corporation and tax exempt. And so until we became tax exempt, we did not take donations. And because to me, asking for money, even saying that we take donations, it's difficult. We don't actually make more than like 1% of commission on the items that we sell. We sell it through a website where they give us a commission. It's very small and we don't sell much of anything. And so I say it's not, there's no tax benefit because of the, we don't make any much of anything and we're fine with that. But if the client wants to donate, it's great because they get a tax break. They get that, charitable, sort
of donation deduction.
Yeah. Yep. And so to them, that's even more. They're getting help, but if they want to help us, like we've gotten a donation from a client that we helped because she was so grateful. And so then when we're able to then give this back and say additionally thank you, I think that's even more professional and makes the client feel even more cared about.
Mm-hmm. Awesome.
Yeah. Well,
thank you so much for coming on today. This was a great interview. I'm sure the listeners learned a lot. I didn't even think about the client being able to use that as a charitable donation on their taxes. That's a pretty good incentive for people to donate. Those mm-hmm. of you out there that have been doing this for any amount of time, you know how expensive it is. We have to travel. We have to put ourselves up in hotels. We have to buy the equipment, and it's thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars a year to get this rolling. If you're creating content, if you're writing books, if you're doing anything that requires that amount of time, it is a massive, massive financial commitment, and every yep. little bit helps. So that's yes. that's a fantastic way to do it yep. and ease the burden.
Right. Yeah. And we travel anywhere across the state too. So, I mean, it's hundreds of dollars that we pay to help them. And so it is expensive, but we will jump on an investigation or a chance to help somebody out in a heartbeat.
Well, hey, thanks for coming on. Real quick, tell people where they can find you, your socials, and how they can follow you.
Of course, the website, mtparanormal.com. There are links down at the bottom where you can go to our Facebook page. And you can follow that. You can see the different things we're doing. We're working on getting some of our findings and reports and published on the Facebook page. So you can kind of see that. We, of course, have legal permission slips from clients to release or not release footage. And we have a YouTube page that you can follow. They will also be posting longer videos too. And so those are the main ways.
Awesome. And we'll have links to those in the show notes. Thank you so much for coming on. And guys, we'll catch you on the next episode of Ghost Hunter Advice. If you want to connect with us, you can email the show, email your stories, email your questions to ghosthunteradvice@gmail.com. You can also connect with us on Facebook and Instagram at Ghost Hunter Advice. And of course, join the Facebook group so that you can get in on the discussion for the episodes and have access to some exclusive live stuff, live trainings. And a real quick announcement before we jump off, the Patreon is coming. And those legal forms that we were talking about, non-disclosures, disclosure agreements, media releases, property permission slips, and other information for your HR and managing your team.
Yep.
We're getting those together. We're popping them up on the Patreon along with special training videos on forensic interviewing, different equipment, theories, and having some very special guests in the parapsychology community and ghost hunting community on there to assist with deep diving the theories. So stay tuned, and I'll see you on the next episode of Ghost Hunter Advice.